Welcome to ICTJ's podcast series on the legacy of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Today we're joined by Stephen J. Rapp, the current United States Ambassador for Global Criminal Justice. Prior to his appointment, Ambassador Rapp served as prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, beginning in January 2007. Ambassador Rapp, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Hannah.
Let me start by asking you, Ambassador, looking very broadly at this institution, what do you think the main lessons are to be learned from this court?
Well, I think the main lesson is that it's possible to carry on these trials in the countries where the crimes was committed, and that the people who experienced these crimes were able to come to court and hear the testimony or participate in the proceedings. It also enabled the court to have probably its most effective program, which was its outreach, which involved employing Sierra Leoneans around the country who themselves screened videos and provided information to their communities about the work of the court, and then also brought to those communities principals of the court, prosecutor and the principal defender and others to answer questions about its work. On the negative side, I suppose it still was the international institution on a hill behind a fence separated from the national judiciary. That was necessary to some extent because it needed to be an international court to enforce international humanitarian law very clearly, to establish the statute that it used, to overcome head of state immunity, to overcome questions about the Lomé amnesty. Now, I will say that we spent a lot of effort, particularly in my tenure and afterwards, in trying to overcome that and to develop a variety of legacy projects, including the Victim Protection Initiative, which works both for the benefit of the court and for national cases. And in other places, we work to strengthen the national system. But my preference generally in terms of these kind of hybridized institutions in the future will be to try to plant them more firmly within the national justice system as extraordinary chambers, for instance, with international participation, even among judges and prosecutors and staff, but still in a way that's not separate from them. And I think that's probably the wave of the future, more the Bosnia model than this one. But under the circumstances, and given the situation with what the court did and the way it was constructed, I think was necessary and appropriate, and its legacy, I think, is overwhelmingly positive.
Now, given this positivity, there are probably opportunities that the court could have taken to do more. Can you think of any specific instances where you feel like there were opportunities that were missed?
I mean, one of the things that we would have loved for the court to have done, and that I approached the justice ministers and attorney generals of successive administrations when I was there, was the question of whether it might be possible for there to be national prosecutions of mid-level individuals working, hopefully, to find that the Lomé amnesty didn't apply because these were prosecutions under international humanitarian law. One of the criticisms that we faced whenever we went out on outreach, everyone young and old would say, why didn't you prosecute the guy in our own district who's still living here or whose family's living here? He was responsible for murdering hundreds or thousands of people. And we'd say, of course, we had this mandate that was developed out of the communication from your government to the UN that called for going after those with the greatest responsibility. And that was interpreted by my predecessor appropriately to mean those that were in a national leadership position within the various armed groups or in assistance to those groups. And so that's the way we approached it. And to a large extent, the response was, look, we got you to do this. You're the ones that we've handed this to. And there wasn't, I think, a strong will to go there. And in other places, like certainly in the former Yugoslavia, the work that the ICTY has had with the Bosnia State Court, initially a mixed court, but also with the prosecutors in the national systems in Croatia and Serbia, has been very positive, working really on the same patch, you know, on the same kind of evidence developing these cases. And that's something that we didn't have in Sierra Leone. And of course, as we look at ICC cases in the future, I'm a strong supporter of positive complementarity, which means, of course, in some cases, the national system can do it all. But in other situations, you'll have the ICC doing one or two or three cases, but then you will have dozens of other individuals that are high level with an enormous amount of blood on their hands that have the potential to continue to destabilize their societies, and you need to have a complementary national effort to do that, and that even though the ICC can't be an aid agency, as to some extent the Yugoslavian Rwanda tribunals have been able to be under their mandate on their completion strategy, it can help coordinate donor assistance. And certainly when the time comes, the prosecutor, the defense, others can be working with those national authorities and sharing information to do those cases. And I mean, that's part of what I see as the model for the prosecution of atrocity crimes in the future. And because of the situation in Sierra Leone with the Lomé Amnesty, we weren't able to do it because of the political will not to really challenge whether that amnesty was applicable in the national system. We hadn't the opportunity to go there.
The method of voluntary contributions to fund the special court made this institution particularly unique, and this model has been criticized for being unsustainable and also criticized as a potential risk for the judicial independence of the court. As former chief prosecutor, how did voluntary contributions affect your work?
Well, it became an enormous part of my attention and time. It was brought home to me in early plenary with the judges, where they, you know, as much as said, look, if the international community doesn't come through with the funds, I'll have to let these people go. Now, they didn't say that publicly, but they said that to me, and I thought, oh, my heavens, I could have the best evidence and the best advocacy, and I could lose. And so I put fundraising right up at the top of my list with other things relating to case preparation. And so I spent a lot of time on the road with other court principals, a third of my time probably, out there talking in capitals about the work of the court. Now, that was outreach, too, in a global way, I suppose, but it was focused on trying to build support, and that involved a different strategy in different states. In the United States, we had the support of the U.S. government, but the willingness to come through with the kind of significant contributions that we needed wasn't always there. As I came on in 2007, I realized that what was happening in the U.S. is the department was saying, well, we might have $3 or $4 million for the court, and we'd say, well, we're really going to need $12 or $13 million. And so we actually developed kind of an independent strategy within the U.S. political process, and we had support from people like Senator Obama, who sponsored a successful amendment while still in his first 2 years as a senator to provide $12 million in funding in fiscal 2007, and then had Republican members, some who quite conservative, who raised the ante, who offered more money. I mean, interestingly, from a political standpoint, as we saw when the Congress before the Charles Taylor arrest passed a resolution 424-1 urging Taylor's arrest and transfer from Nigeria, there was bipartisan support for the court. So we took advantage of that. In each country, we had to implement a different kind of strategy, and that required a lot of energy and time away from the process of developing the cases and dealing with the victims and other things. So we did have to spend a lot more effort selling ourselves, which may have been helpful to some extent, but it certainly detracted from the judicial work. And then it created these periodic crises where we were very close to running out of funds. And there was an attitude on some in the court who said, oh, well, the international community has come through because it's always come through before. And you say, well, that's because people went out and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. If they didn't go out and push, the day would come when there would be no money. And you'd be essentially in a situation where judicial processes would have to stop, defense attorneys wouldn't be getting paid, witnesses couldn't travel, and you'd have a crisis with some irreparable cost to the process. And so you were constantly looking at that calendar and saying, when are the funds running out? What are we going to do?
I wanted to ask you about the case of Charles Taylor. How do you think this case specifically affected the broader legacy of this court? And do you think that the success in this case sends any kind of message to other leaders in the region about accountability and justice?
The Taylor case is important on many levels. First and foremost, to someone like myself personally and the role that I played before joining the U.S. government as an international prosecutor in the Rwanda Tribunal and the Sierra Leone Court, and as someone who believes very much in fulfilling the legacy of Nuremberg to hold people, even men of great power, to account, set in motion evils which touch the homes of victims. This was historic and important. And one of the interesting things, of course, that came as a result of us having moved our case to The Hague and having begun the trial and run the prosecution case in the facilities of the ICC is that everyone thought this was an ICC case. And I remember telling my friend Luis Moreno Ocampo on the streets of The Hague, I said, you know, I want to congratulate you in advance because tomorrow there will be a judgment involving a chief of state, and they'll be saying it was done at the ICC. And indeed, there were several news organizations, some quite famous, that referred to it as an ICC conviction the next day. And it wasn't. I tended to not be negative about that because I view these courts as all part of an international justice project and working together. And some of the same people that have worked at the special court have worked in the other courts. But it was an important success for that entire project. I remember hearing from those that were witnesses on the day that Charles Taylor was arrested in Nigeria and transported to Liberia and put on a helicopter and flown into the premises of the special court at 7 o'clock at night as the sun was setting, as it does at that hour every night in Freetown on the coast of West Africa, and the helicopter coming out of the clouds to land at the port that's within the detention center, within the facilities of the court, and thousands of Sierra Leoneans standing on the roofs of their houses watching this happen and being just amazed, not believing that this could ever happen. And the prospect that anyone like that could face justice was really beyond hope. And the court delivered on that hope on that day. And then, with the work of all of its officers, was able to finish the job thanks to the witnesses, more than 100 of which traveled from Africa to the Hague to testify for the prosecution and defense. So it was extremely important for the people of Sierra Leone. And having visited both countries since that conviction, having been in Liberia in October, there was a lot of enthusiasm for what had been accomplished there and a lot of belief that they should be developing approaches themselves to accountability for the crimes that had been committed in their country. So it's not, of course, just Charles Taylor, but that symbol of someone that was so immensely powerful in the region and who reached the point of president, and one thought he might never give it up, to have been brought to justice was immensely important, and the court finished the job. Certainly, in my view, it's hard to imagine being involved in a project for the rest of my life that I think will have been so important for the victims of these crimes.
In closing, I was wondering if you had any other final reflections on lessons that institutions doing justice today can learn from the experience of this court, and how can we move forward in this international justice project that you described with the best practices of this institution in mind?
Well, the most important thing about this court, I've talked earlier about the fact that it tried cases at the scene of the crime, but was this the partnership, the hybridization, the fact that it included personnel, even up to the very senior levels, from both national and international community. I mean, there is a tendency for people who believe in international justice and who doubt the capacity of countries that have gone through conflict and haven't developed strong institutions of judicial accountability to believe, well, we've got to do these things exclusively at the international level. And I think, as someone that came into this process in 2001, and not knowing the societies and the cultures that I was dealing with, I found in the Rwanda tribunal what I was able to develop with my African colleagues to be the most valuable part of that experience. But even at that court, we had relatively little in terms of personnel from Rwanda. That in contrast to the Sierra Leone situation, where 60% of the people in the court were Sierra Leonean. And so you had individuals who came from that culture, who understood it, and I think it helped us develop stronger cases, helped us tell the witnesses who were telling the truth and those that weren't, helped us determine whether witnesses that were seeking support and needed it for their protection or for their subsistence if they'd been relocated, or whether they were seeking an inappropriate reward. I think it made us so much better, and I think that the Sierra Leone participants in the court benefited from the relationship with the nationals. It's, I think, had that benefit for all of us, that partnership. So this is why, as I look at complementarity, at least the model of the partnership between national and internationals, if only on a temporary basis, I think is the formula for effective and independent prosecution, investigation, judging of cases in the future after periods of conflict that have included mass atrocities.
Well, Ambassador Rapp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Okay, enjoyed it, Hannah.